I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, Tim, good to go when you are.
Cue the music.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into dear Lovejoy.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Cooker, spelt Quooker, pronounced Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I love it, and thank you very much for sponsoring the podcast to all the guys at Cooker. Today is a special. It is the 2019 selection box. Is that what we're calling it, Mark?
I hadn't put box on it. Hi, listeners, by the way.
That's Mark, by the way. Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Tim. I hadn't put box on it, but I like that. If you want to make it sound sort of Christmassy, like a chocolate box, then
yeah.
I just called it the Dear Lovejoy 2019 selection.
Well, it was originally going to be a best of, but we decided to call it. Well, you decided to call it a selection.
So here's the thing. I thought that it would be very unfair to all the rest of the guests who didn't make it on here on such a prestigious, show. And so what I tried to, instead, what I tried to do is do a really nice cross section of all the very different guests we've had. Because there's one thing you cannot say about the Dear Lovejoy podcast, and it's not, we do have a diverse and exciting range of guests. Tim, you cannot say that.
Yeah,
are you trying to say that?
No, I'm not trying to say
fine,
that at all, because you can't say that, Mark.
No,
it's diverse. If nothing else, it's diverse.
And so what I've done is I've taken. Trying to just take a little clip from a wide range of people, and I think you're going to really enjoy it.
Someone asked me for a description of the Dear Lovejoy podcast the other day, and I said, well, it's just lots of stuff. I couldn't really...
Ever the salesman, Tim.
It's just conversation, isn't it, basically? Yeah. And it's nice conversation with interesting people, or mailbags where it's just us two, no one interesting on it. But
hey, come on now.
Hey, self-deprecation. So who are we going to start with then? Should we kick it off and get going on this?
Okay, well, he was a great guest. His name was Colin Salmon.
Yes, love Colin Salmon. Known him for years.
He's an actor.
Yes.
And we've
from Luton.
That's right. We've had other actors on. We've had Patterson Joseph was one, and Andy Nyman. And we went to his dressing room. Do you remember that in Soho, which is great fun.
I can't forget that. Yes.
So, but I loved this clip because this is you and Colin, and you're talking about how music and football bring people together, and I thought that would be a very nice place to start.
Oh, okay. Let's listen to it. This is Colin Salmon. But did you have a problem being a black guy band and a punk band?
I got a lot of grief from black boys for it. You know,
really?
They used to get really angry as like punks because it was a whole soul boy thing. So I had this two dual life because I would go to Kester All Nighters. I'd play a gig on the drums for the punk band, change me clothes, go wash, and then get in the car in the Capri 1970-71. And off we go with Al Jarreau. Easy, let your love ring out. I had two lives. It was fantastic. And I saw Young Soul Rebels. I have issues with the film, but it wasn't far off the mark. But that actually brings us to Two Tone, because that was our music.
My favourite.
That was the British music.
My
that
favorite.
Was the thing when we connected. And that's really important. People really understand that.
I ended up knowing John Bradbury really well. He's died now, sadly. And the amount of conversations. He was such a lovely person to me. When I was going through my sort of depression, he'd go, come out and have a coffee with me. We'd just sit. And I couldn't believe I was sitting talking to someone from The Specials. He was such a lovely guy. But we used to talk about it. You don't realise how important that band was. Black and white people on the stage, mixing of the music, and people. I think people seem to forget that there was very few bands like that, and still are very few bands.
Well, you have to. There's two things they did for me. Jerry Dammers freed Nelson Mandela.
Yeah,
he wrote the song, and that created the. It's a spiritual thing when everybody sings something. You can't deny what that song was.
Do you think it is that powerful?
Oh, mate,
do you?
I believe when a world believes enough. And starts calling to the universe, I don't believe you can ignore it.
Right.
And secondly, the most important thing he did, well, they're both very important. Scar was a music of skinheads. I was around those boys.
Yeah.
And they were going right. And he took all these right wingers and he turned them left. And they didn't even know it happened.
Yeah.
They were so beautiful, the Specials, so important. Because they literally, you know, you've done too much, much too young. You married a kid when you could be having fun with me. I mean, I had mates who had kids at 16, 17. And like that song, we all started to think a bit about that. And it was, yeah. You know what I mean? And it was, you go to those gigs even now. I went and saw them a few years ago at Brixton, not about 3-4 years ago. And I looked at the crowd and I thought, you know, I'm no Chelsea fan, but I got to be honest, they were all in there. And it was like, yeah, good. Because that's what it needs. It needs... That's what music can do, I think. Music liberates people.
Music and sport.
Music and sport.
Sport can do the same thing.
Oh, no question.
Yeah. Well, it has done, I think, with football over the years.
Oh, it's extraordinary. You
know, yeah.
I mean, and I love them both. Yeah. I mean, I love football so much, I hate it sometimes.
Colin Salmon there, what an amazing guy he is. People like him make me sick, though. Because he can do everything, can't he? He can sing, he can play an instrument, he can
act.
Yeah, he brings communities together. He's smart. He's funny.
And that makes you sick.
Yeah.
Nice people, Tim. They really get you down.
Talented people. Okay. Yeah, because you know, there's no beginning to my talents. You know, there's. I can't play an instrument. I can't even speak a foreign language. There's very little I can do. I'm like most of the people out there, you know. And you get these people who go, right, I'm going to learn to do everything.
You're a man of the useless people.
I am, yeah. But I think people can look at me and go, yeah, he's an inspiration. He's got himself TV money without having a talent. Hey, talking about talented people, the next clip, Mark's done a list for me here, is Giles Brandreth. Now, this guy... I mean, the way he speaks, his language is so beautiful. I love every time I have a conversation with him. Lovely warm feeling. He was one of the most popular podcasts from last year, wasn't he?
He really was. And I was thinking recently while I was putting this together, I was thinking he's one of those people that enters the room and joy comes with him. Do you know what I mean? And I was thinking, imagine spending Christmas Day with that man. How fun that would be.
I don't know the clip you've chosen, but during the time we discussed poetry, did you get to that?
We discuss language and emojis and poetry, and your contribution was maybe not quite as highbrow as Giles's. I won't say what it is.
I love it when Giles tries to talk to me about poetry because it's the one thing I can. I understand opera. I understand ballet. I understand like art. I can look at all those sort of forms of art and the classics. But poetry, I just don't get at all. I like literally can't get my head around it at all.
Sorry, excuse me. I studied First World War poetry at school.
Really?
For English.
Boom, boom, boom.
All right. And it's really good. It's really good. It's worth, if you're going to get into anything, you can see someone's in a trench writing.
Struggle with lyrics. I listen to artists constantly on the radio going, and I've really bared my soul here in my lyrics. I'm thinking,
believe you put up Baldrick's poem.
Just words. Boom, boom. Right, here's Giles Brandreth.
But I do love words. I do love language. Mm. And for a variety, I mean, language is fundamental. I did a book this last year that's been a bit of a bestseller called Have You Eaten Grandma?
Mm-hmm.
It's about punctuation, spelling. Well, obviously, Have You Eaten Grandma? with the comma or without the comma makes all the difference. Mm-hmm. And it's because everything is about language, in a sense. You can communicate with a hug mm-hmm. or even with an emoji. But language is what you really... When I was writing the book, I got a team of young people together to talk about how they're using language now. Because though I have children and grandchildren, I thought, I want to see how people in their early 20s are using language. And when we met up, it was around the time of Valentine's Day. So I said, love letters. Who writes a good love letter? Who gets a good love letter? Not one of these eight young people had ever received or sent a love letter. Mm-hmm. One of them actually thought it was a kind of contraceptive. I said, no, I think you're thinking of French letters. He said, I never heard of French letters. He said, love letters, aren't they? I said, no. Love letters are things you write. He had no idea. And a girl looked totally bemused. Said, oh, I think it's a bit creepy, you know. I said, really? I mean, if somebody fancies you, you know, how do they let you know? Well, you know, she said, send me a smiley face. And I said, if you fancy them back, what do you do? I send them a smiley face. And I said, if you really fancy them, what do you do? She said, a smiley face with the tongue hanging out. I said, oh. And if he fancies you in return, what does he send you? She said, an aubergine. Don't go there. Well, it is a language of sorts, and it is fun.
Yeah, it is. I like emojis.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? It's just a beautiful poem. And if somebody sent you that handwritten, it is amazing.
Plagiarism it is.
It is plagiarism. Yeah. Can I tell you a gift? I'll slip this into your podcast. And this is giving away something very, very valuable indeed. Mm. If you want to be successful as a wooer, on the first or second date, when you're chatting up whoever you're chatting up, find out, in passing, say to them, what's your favourite poem? Actually, do you have a favourite poem? Do you, Tim, have a favourite? Out of interest.
No.
You don't?
No. Okay. I'm sorry. I don't, I've discussed it on the podcast. I don't really understand. Poetry. Fine. It doesn't move me.
Are you into girls?
Yep.
Fine. So, most of the girls you know, because I've met one or two of them, I didn't know you were into them because they don't mention you, but I do know that you knew them. They may have a favourite poem.
Yeah.
And if they do, this is the trick. You find out about it at date two. Mm-hmm. And then on date four, you say, I've got something for you. Mm. And then over the coffee, you recite the poem to them by heart. That's a gift.
I've been busy sending dick pics, and I haven't really. Yeah, exactly. I haven't really done.
Do you know that's the one? I know you haven't. I know you haven't, because you're not a total fool.
I've never sent one in my life.
And you do know that is the real turnoff. That's the one thing they really don't want, because they've got a library of bigger and better.
Naked Martin. What I would say to you on the that's a good idea though. I like that idea. I might try it.
I think it's a bit late in your case. Stick with the waxing and the dick pics. I'm so sorry about this. It's a shame to be losing the audience so quickly when it was going so well. There may be on a different channel an edited version of this in which the interviewer is cut out. Who knows?
I was saying to you at Sunday brunch, though, I get so frustrated. And when I listen to
tell you get so frustrated. Can I tell you, it's only frustrated men who feel the need to talk about dick pics. Normal, healthy men with active lives, they're not obsessing about it. It doesn't even crop into their heads.
When you get desperate.
But you could not wait to get those words out, dick pics, with a kind of relish.
I love the idea that Giles just went with that. That was really funny. that really amused me. Hey, who we got next then, Mark?
Well, this year we had on some really great health experts, a lot of them actually. Rangan actually was our first guest. Rangan Chatterjee, you remember, was the first guest of the year?
I don't know. I remember him, but I didn't know it was the first.
We had Dr. Simon Eccles. No, sorry, Simon Eccles, who was great, wasn't he? He was a skin...
plastic
expert.
Surgeon.
But also very knowledgeable about skin. Check that one. That podcast is great. Dr. Giles Yeo, who was great. But I chose Megan Rossi because she just was, she just brought the whole thing, made it much clearer. We talked about gut stuff before, gut biome and all that sort of stuff before, but she was the one who really made it a lot clearer in my head.
good communicator, Mark. And I tell you why she's a good communicator, because so many people contacted me afterwards and said, I've just ordered her book.
Yeah.
Friends, a lot of friends did as well, because I think we're all fascinated by our gut. We've become, as a species, we've become obsessed with what we stick inside us. Most creatures out there, as I always say, are just desperately trying to get calories on board, whereas we're going, oh, what will this one do for me? And so we're desperately looking at that. She was fascinating. Her book's interesting as well. And she did give me some...
Kefir, yeah.
Which I'll tell you about after the clip.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is Megan Rossi.
We're talking about good diets. What are we looking to actually achieve?
Well, I think one of the key concepts we see coming through is around plant-based diet diversity. So trying to get as many different plant-based foods in our diet as we can. Now, this actually comes from all six plant-based food groups. So we've got our whole grains, things like the oats, the whole grain rice, etc. We've got the fruit, apples, strawberries. We've got the veggies, you know, aubergine, tomatoes. We've got the legumes, so things like chickpeas and lentils. We've got the seeds, so things like pumpkin seeds, linseeds. And then we've got the nuts, things like macadamia nuts, almonds, etc. So trying to actually get in a diverse range of them, you know, as you can, is kind of what we see as the best thing to feed our gut microbes, which, remember, then communicate with our brain, communicate with our heart, make the gut lining actually really quite strong as well, and help support our immune system.
But why? Why do we want so, such a diverse range? Yeah. I mean, the cynic in me will say that we're lucky to be able to have macadamia nuts growing, you know, I'm in London. We don't have them. I don't assume we have them growing here, and we don't have all these different types of vegetables that you're discussing. So why do I need these stuff?
So if you think about these trillions of microbes living in the lower part of your intestine, each one of them actually has slightly different taste preferences, like humans do. So if we want to feed a diverse range of microbes, we have to have all the different plant-based foods, which contain slightly different chemicals. There's, you know, 30,000 different types of plant chemicals in a lot of these plant-based foods.
Yeah.
So we, to get them, and therefore to feed the different bacteria what they like, we need to have that diversity piece in there. And things like, a simple example is dietary fiber. You know, a lot of people go, yeah, I know I need to take dietary fiber. I need more of it. I might just take a supplement. Well, actually, there's close to 100 different types of dietary fiber. And again, each type feeds a different bacteria.
But why do we need to feed so many? I mean, my granddad was just meat and two veg, same bloody meals every, every day. But he lives to 96 or something, so he did all right. Why are we looking for food from Africa and South America when we live in Britain? I'm just wondering, in the future, I can see a movement towards only buy local food,
and
then I won't be able to eat jackfruit. Or
you don't need to have all those, though. If you think of just eating locally grown fruit and veg, etc., you would easily be able to get your 30 different types in. It's just that they're not necessarily available in the mainstream supermarkets. But if you went to, you know, your local farmers, you could 100% get all those different diversity type foods in. Now, the reason why this is important and to have the different gut bacteria is that all of the studies to date have associated people who've got more ranges of bacteria in them with better things like mental health, lower body weight, better metabolic function, lower risk of things like Parkinson's disease, etc. So there is this clear association between those who have that diverse range of microbes in them and the lower risk of all these chronic diseases. Mm. I guess the exact pathways and the mechanisms between them, we're still trying to understand, but we kind of think about it like, if you've got more bacteria in you with the different skills, it's kind of like a football team. You know, you've got the forward, you've got the back, they can all do different things. If you'll have just forwards, then actually you're not going to do very well overall.
So that was Megan Rossi. She came with a present. I hope she's not listening to this, because she gave me some kefir.
How's it going, Tim?
I grew lots of it.
Did you grow too much of it?
I just didn't bother eating it.
Oh, you absolutely didn't.
I could, you say that.
I do, and I'll say it again.
You say that.
And I will say it again.
I just kept not
fancying it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's because I'm growing it. I didn't trust myself.
Why have a nice little cup of kefir when you can have an Egg McMuffin for breakfast?
No, not me at all. However, I just thought it was, I don't know. It's still sitting in my fridge, actually. I don't know if it's still alive.
Of course it is.
Oh, does it live forever?
Yeah.
Like an Oasis song.
Absolutely.
But I don't know. I struggle with the idea of when I found out that it was alive. It's like when someone gives you a plant for a present. It's like, oh, great, I've got to keep something else alive. You know, I've already got 3 kids and a cat, and now I've got a pot plant. And someone gave me a chili plant once. I was like, oh, no, I don't want to keep that alive as well. And it's like this, now I've got to keep this thing alive. Do you remember people gave you those things years ago? I never had one, but the kids used to have these, like...
Tamagotchi.
Is that what it was called? It was like a digital thing to keep alive. Yeah. What the hell? Yeah. Well, why do you need more things to keep alive? It's like, why do people... Cats are easy, aren't they? Dogs. I always look at dogs.
They're admin, aren't they, dogs?
All my life, I've thought I want a dog, right? Yeah. And then I look at people, because I go for a walk often around in nature, yeah, as part of my process, my disciplines and my meditation. And I watch people with dogs and I think, especially at this time of year, we're recording this in the winter, and I think, you've got to clean that dog now. Look at the state of its feet. Where's that going to go? You've got to clean it before it gets in the car if you've driven down here.
Your car will stinky if it's wet.
Yeah, I'm like, this is kind of... a lot of admin involved in a dog, and I'm like, oh, who needs something else to look after? However, this is a London dog. If you live in the countryside and you can just open your door and get the thing and tear around, I think dogs are amazing then. A great idea.
I'm going to get you one of those little rocks with eyes on. Do you remember you used to see those when you get to the seaside?
Yeah.
I'm going to get you one of those next year.
Well, I've actually got a couple. I've made some. They're out there in the garden. I don't know if you can still see them, but yeah. I can't remember what they're called now, but yeah, you can actually, this is the most amazing thing. You can buy kits.
What, rock eye kit?
Yeah, you bring rocks to life. You can actually just go out into the garden and get a rock or whatever, but they do it. Anyway, yeah, so that was Megan Rossi. Who are we doing next? Oh, really important one next. Looked on the list.
Yeah, drug reform has been massive this year on our podcast, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been
an eye-opening year, I would say. Would you agree?
I've changed my mind about so much. Hey, and interestingly, I'm willing to change my mind about anything else as well. So if you've got any things that I need to change my mind about, I love the idea that Neil Wood came along and absolutely started with Peter Blexley.
So Peter Blexley was last year. It was the end of last year.
Right, and then Neil Woods came along.
And he said, get Neil Woods on. He's great. And since then we've had...
He didn't do that, actually. The listeners did. Yeah. The listeners told us to get Neil Woods on. And I got Neil Woods on the podcast, who's an ex-plainclothes copper, who's now believes we need drug reform, which really is legalization of drugs. And I had my mind changed. And I thought people were mental when they said it, you know, when Peter Blexley said it. And it just makes so much sense. And this has been a bit of a journey for me now. Hate using that expression, but it is, looking into it throughout the last year. I'm just so sold on legalization of drugs. Prohibition did not work for alcohol. We had Al Capone killing everyone in America and all that sort of stuff. Why on earth we think it's going to work for drugs? It isn't. It clearly isn't. Violence is escalating, and the substances people are buying are dangerous. Please, let's try and look at this. Everyone should listen to this. And if you like what Neil Woods is saying in this clip, I reckon you should go back and listen to the whole thing. You can also listen to the podcast I did with Jason Reed as well.
That was a recent one, yeah.
That was a recent one, because he works, he's the, what's his role at UK Leap or Leap UK? Chief exec?
Something like that, yeah, yeah.
And he's such a good guy. He really nails all the arguments and answers more questions that I didn't ask with Neil Woods. Anyway, have a listen to this, and hopefully it'll make you think about it as well.
My career, I used to do level 2 undercover work, which is street level, down and dirty, purchasing drugs to infiltrate organised crime groups who supply the drug in cities, primarily heroin and crack cocaine. I did that over the space of 14 years, between 1993 and 2007. Caught lots of gangsters. In fact, I put people in prison for a cumulative total of over 1,000 years. So I was very successful at what I did.
So what then changed your mind on it?
Well... I mean, at the start, I believed in it. I believed in what I was doing. I was very pleased to be catching the bad guy at the end of the operation. But in order to do that, I had to manipulate vulnerable people and put those people at further risk. I justified doing that at the time, that the end justifies the means. But eventually, it took a long time for me, actually, the penny finally dropped. That the reason my work was getting more and more difficult year after year, that organised crime was getting more and more violent every year without fail, was actually my fault. Well, not just me, but people like me who did the same kind of work. Because, you know, police are brilliant at catching drug dealers. Brilliant. They'll catch them year after, week after week if you give them the resources and the instruction to do so. But police were more likely to catch the low-hanging fruit than the top people. So it thins it out. It's a Darwinian thing. And the most successful gangster who is the one who is the most willing to be violent. So over time, the policing of drugs makes organised crime more violent. So I was contributing to that. So eventually, and I had to look back on my 14 years of undercover work and realise that the end didn't justify the means at all. Not only was I causing harm to individuals who actually needed help, but I was also making society more violent because of organised crime's response. Because police never shrink the size of the market. Never. You can arrest, you can fill the prisons up, you could double the population in prison with more drug dealers. You could do that with the resources. But it doesn't change the shape of the market at all. Policing only, it doesn't reduce the size of it, it only changes the shape of it.
Fascinating man, Neil Woods. And
what I liked about, I mean, that clip, it was actually, that's the reason I chose that, it was a great highlight, because he had a lot of regret in his voice, but he also had a lot of hope. You know, the do you know what I mean? That's what he was like when you were talking to him. He felt very regretful that what he'd done maybe had made this worse, but you felt with him that he was looking forward to a hopefully slightly brighter future. But there we go. And we also had, as we said, Jason Reed, but also we had Johan Hari, who was great.
Johan Hari came on to talk about depression, but he ended up talking about drug reform before that as well. So he's got some great points on it. But they all speak the same language, Jason Reed, Neil Woods, Peter Blexley, Johan Hari, which is we need drug reform. We need it now. It's not just for this country. It's for the world. You know, it's definitely in South America need it. We need us to get on board with it so they can stop having the slaughtering of millions of people down there over cocaine and, you know, there's all the problems in all over the world. Anyway, please, if do yourself a favor, listen to Johan Hari, Jason Reed, and Neil Woods' podcast, because they're all fascinating stuff. And another deep subject where I had my mind changed was when Catherine Mannix came on, which is our next clip. I've just noticed Mark's chosen. And she's a palliative nurse, and she came on to discuss death, a subject that people don't like talking about.
No.
It's quite an important issue in my life because my brother died when he was young. He was only 37. So it's an interesting thing. And I've had to spend a lot of time, well, I don't have to, but I do spend a lot of time thinking about death. And she made death seem...
not so bad.
Well, I'd go... I hate to say this because it just feels so wrong, but I want to experience it. We all experience death.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a father to three children, and experiencing watching the birth of your children is amazing. I've watched the experience of other people dying, which is horrific, but it's happened. And but she's made me think the death rate is still 100%. We're all going to die. And I want to go through it like everybody else because I think it's I want to know what happens.
And I think her role and her what you know what she does is she brings a little bit of dignity to that process, which is really cool. I've had a pretty shitty year actually, death wise. I would say a very close relative and a friend and a good friend have both died this year, So I just include this because I just thought her story was. The reason is the story that inspired her to write her book.
I've never read a book. I only read factual books, really, but I've never read a book which made me cry. And if you want to cry, it's actually a really interesting book. I had to read it in stages, though. I could only do sort of one chapter at a time, and I literally cried all the way through it. But there's something magical about it. It's as I remember tweeting her because she sent me her book, and I said it's either the Oh no, sorry, I didn't tweet her. I direct messaged her on Twitter, and I said, "It's either the worst book I've ever read or the best." And I think it comes into the best because we are terrified of death. I'm not so much anymore. Here she is, Catherine Mannix.
"30 years after I'd started working in palliative care, realising that nobody knew anything about dying, everybody was absolutely terrified of what they thought dying was like. What they thought dying was like was nothing like what dying is like. And at the beginning of my palliative care career, I thought, you know, in 30 years' time, we'll have educated people and I'll be meeting people who know more and they won't be so afraid and this will all be just so much easier. And that just wasn't happening. Mm. And I've spent the last 10 years of my clinical practice in a big, busy inner-city teaching hospital. And one day I got called to the emergency room and there was an elderly patient on a stretcher who'd come in with the paramedics who'd been doing chest compressions on the way into hospital. And there was one son weeping beside this unconscious patient, and then the wife and another couple of brothers arrived. And I'd seen this scenario so many times, but this one was the one that kind of said to me, it's time to do something now. The patient was in his 90s. He had things wrong with so many bits of him that, you know, I think his liver worked fine kind of thing, but his heart wasn't good and his lungs were a bit knackered and his kidneys weren't working and bits of his nervous system weren't right anymore. And he'd been what we would call, in my neck of the woods, a creaking gait for right. years. And I said to his astonished children, his astonished sons, if your dad ever got so sick that he could die, what did he say he would want? And they said, we never talked about it.
Mm.
And then one of them said, actually, do you know what? Dad did try to talk to me about this. And I said, Dad, man, don't be so maudlin. You know, you're going to live forever. There's no need to worry about that kind of thing. And this son is in his 70s, started crying. And then his brother stepped forward and kind of stuck his hand on his weeping brother's arm to try and console him. And said, actually, it wasn't just you. Dad asked me if I'd make one of those attorney documents with him.
That story's in the book, isn't it?
There's a very similar story in the book. And actually, at that point, I just thought, we can't keep doing this one family at a time.
Yeah.
By the time we finish this conversation, we'll have another family who understands what normal dying is going to be like and what the process is that we're going to be supporting them through. But this is like the starfish on the beach story, isn't it? So you know the story.
No.
So there's an old man looking down the beach and he can see a young boy and the young boy keeps bending down and then standing up and flinging his arms and he looks as though he's dancing. The old man goes down to see what's happening and the little boy is picking up stranded starfish and he's throwing them back into the water. He says, what are you doing? And the little boy says, well, all these starfish, they're going to die if we don't get them back into the water. And the old man says, well, look at this beach. There are thousands of stranded starfish. Nothing you can do will make a difference. And the little boy smiles at him and he picks up another starfish and he flings it back in the ocean and says, well, I made a difference to that one.
Mm.
Now, in palliative care at the moment, we're meeting families one family at a time. We're making a difference to that one. But everybody's going to die.
Well, yeah, what is the death rate at the moment?
It's still running at roughly 100%. So, you know, and in the new NHS plan, we're going to reduce deaths by 500,000 a year, which is quite interesting because the death rate in England and Wales is about 520,000 deaths a year.
Is it?
So I want to be one of the 20,000 that isn't immortal, actually, right. You know. So there I was in casualty with this family and just thinking, somebody's got to do something about the public understanding of dying. I kind of wandered around the hospital for the next few weeks just thinking, somebody's got to do something about, somebody. Mm. And gradually, I think it just dawned on me that nobody was going to step up.
Well,
and maybe I could.
Well, this book is powerful stuff, honestly. It's really changed the way I see it all. That was Catherine Mannix. Let's have a quick word from our sponsors.
Turn on the cooker. Cooker spelled with a Q-U. Turn on the cooker and instantly make a brew. Turn on the cooker. Cooker spelled with a Q-U. Turn on the cooker. Hot water for vegetables too. La, la.
Yeah, this podcast is sponsored by Cooker, spelt Quooker, pronounced Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It does your normal hot water, your normal cold water. It does 100 degree boiling hot water. It does chilled filtered water, and it does chilled filtered sparkling water. Woo-hoo! As well. People often say, hey, that sounds so dangerous, having a 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It's not dangerous at all, because there's a it's aerated. So you put your hand through it, you're not going to burn. Obviously, if you leave your hand in it for long enough, you'll burn. But
you can do that with a kettle.
Exactly. But the other thing is, it's got a safety feature on it. You have to push the, I think it's called tap and turn or something, or push and turn.
Yeah, it's basically a sort of child and dimwit lock, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it took Mark about 3 or 4 times to
shut
come
your face
here before he could get how to use it. You can't just do it. You have to learn how to use it. So it's perfectly safe. One of the greatest things I've ever had in my kitchen. I just love it. I love the hot water. Vegetables, immediately you put hot water on it, they're boiling. You can also do all your brews in it, as you know. And also now you've got the sparkling filtered water in it, if you go for that option. I mean, I love it, but I love sparkling filtered water. So
oh, man.
I drink a lot of that. I don't know why I like it. You love it as well.
Oh, yeah. It's like having a Coke without all the stuff in it.
But because you drink sparkling water a lot, don't you?
I drink a lot.
Has it got a salt in it, though?
Yeah, it's all got, it's mineral water, isn't it, essentially?
Water.
So, you know.
Okay. I'd have like one glass a night with my dinner.
I
and I absolutely
about
love it.
2 litres a day.
Anyway, thank you so much for Cooker for sponsoring the podcast. We love you dearly. Back 2019 selection box, loads of different exciting guests clipped together in one show. Our next clip is Dr. Raoul Jandio. He was an amazing guy, wasn't he?
Man, we had sort of boy crushes on him when he left, didn't he? He was just fascinating and brilliant, and I knew nothing about brain surgery.
Yeah, he's a brain surgeon. It was a boiling hot day, I remember. He came in, he looked immaculate.
Yeah.
He sat down. I do think to begin with he was a bit like, oh god, here we go again, another interview, don't you? A bit.
Yeah, I think maybe that was a bit of nerves or something, but he do you know what, going through the interview, he kept saying to you, Tim, that is a great question. Tim, that is a great question. Tim, no one's ever asked me that before. And it was, I'm not doing his accent.
He said at the end, he said, great to jam with you, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
Great,
that's it.
Great
yeah,
to
that's it.
Mind jam with you or something. He said it was really good. But yeah, it was boiling hot. I think he arrived and he thought, oh, another load of rubbish questions. About
a couple of cowboys sat in
yeah,
a kitchen.
About the brain. And then, and because I liked the subject.
And you loved the book as well. So.
I did enjoy the book because it's something we know, you know, what are we, right? No animal is conscious apart from us, apparently. Let's say that, just for argument's sake. Let's say we're the only conscious animal. The bit which is conscious is clearly in our brains somewhere. The bit which makes you,
yeah,
to sit here and have all your dark thoughts and unhappy thoughts.
Thanks, Tim.
And me is me. It's all in there in the brain. And hearing what he said, what clip did we choose on this, Mark? What did you choose?
Well, this is what it's like to operate on a brain and subsequently remove a, this is a little bit bleak, but remove a tumour from a brain. But it was so, it's just so interesting, I just thought.
By the way, this guy is so obsessed with being the best brain surgeon in the world that when he goes for Chinese food, he uses chopsticks in his left hand
to
try and make him as ambidextrous as possible.
Good for him.
Because when he goes into someone's brain, he says it's so delicate in there and you have to be so accurate. He wants to be able to use both hands equally. That is how passionate he is about his art. Let's hear from him. It It's because it's interesting what a brain actually is, because we think it's a muscle, but it's not, is it? Yeah. And you, I mean, the way you describe it's quite yucky, really. Because
I thought it was beautiful the way I was describing it.
it sort of is, but
too
I just
much for you.
Well, I just imagined it was a muscle, and then you said no, it's more like a flan. You put your finger in it, it'll keep going all the way through, and you go, oh, really?
Ew. I see what you're saying about flan. Yeah, bread pudding and flan. The texture is like nothing else, and part of becoming a brain surgeon, you go through other training. So I've operated all over the body.
Right.
First of all, it's white. And I said, this is a total tangent. But I had a patient, he was a butcher. And I said, well, you got some issues there where the, you know, I explained it to him where the brain comes down and turns into the spinal cord right here at the base of the skull.
Yeah. Because
if the jellyfish is trapped in the skull, its tentacles have to exit. And there's a hole at the bottom of the skull.
Yeah.
Foramen magnum. And he said to me, oh, that white shiny part when we cut the animals up. I said, wait, that was extremely visceral explanation. But it is flesh, but it's not red.
Oh.
But it gets way more blood than your bicep. And the bicep is red. Your heart is red. It's white.
Why?
But it's exactly right. Exactly. That's why it's like, what is this? This is a that's when I first saw, I was actually going to be a heart surgeon. When they opened the skull and I saw I had the opportunity to potentially be in neurosurgery, I was just like, what is that? All this blood and flesh in our scalps. And then the skull has this bony texture. And then you get past the skull like ice fishing. You make a circle. And you still don't see the brain. It's in a sheath. Like about the thickness of a parachute material.
Right.
And so then there's this sheath and it's plump. And then you pick up the sheath like with a tweezer. You get just a tiny thing, little cut. And you insert an instrument in, and you kind of zip it open like ripping a blazer or a dress.
Uh-huh.
And then all this white, clear white fluid. It's filled with proteins and nutrients and even diseases, but it's clear and odorless, unlike blood, unlike all the other juices. So you get this clear fluid that's providing the buoyancy in a floating aquarium, and then there's this white, gently throbbing, undulating thing called the brain. It's, you have to see it once if you can. You can't because you're not a surgeon, but it's something that you would say, this is completely different. And then you get those iconic ridges.
Yeah.
And what those are, and other animals don't have them, and unfortunately people who aren't engaged or have brain injury, they can lose those too as kids. It's basically like trying to take a pizza and crunching it together like an accordion to put it into a box.
Mm-hmm.
The ridges just give you more square footage or square acreage on the canopy because the thoughts, think of it as a mushroom, the thoughts are on the canopy.
Right.
So the surface of your brain is sparking all the thoughts. And then underneath it, the rest of the brain, the part you don't see, it's just crisscrossing pathways. And so when you see that top of the brain, that undulating pattern, the serpentine blood vessels is like a Jackson Pollock painting. It's something quite brilliant to see. And the operating room lights really put it under quite a bit of shine. And it's such an amazing thing.
So when you're operating on this, let's say you're taking away a tumor. When you're going in, you're taking a tumor out of the brain. Where are you taking it out of? The white bit in the middle?
Brilliant question. I think that's probably the first time a non-surgeon doctor has asked that. Exactly. Wait a second. So you've got the brain, and there's a deep-seated tumor.
Mm-hmm.
But the pathway to the tumor is healthy brain.
Yeah.
How are you going to get to that? Well, there are corridors within the brain that we can simply forgive the indelicacy, bulldoze through and dissect and get to that deeper core, the nucleus where the tumor is, shell it out, collapse it onto itself, and suck it out of that channel we have made. So the biggest part of neurosurgery is learning what parts of the brain you can simply go through and what parts you can't. And that's the first thing you learn is, wait a second, we know since we have two frontal lobes and two occipital lobes, those are safe passages to the deep brain. We know language is on the left. Oh man, don't even think about it. And in fact, when you see a scan and the patient has an issue on the left, the dominant hemisphere, right away, we call it the dominant hemisphere, left, yeah. Because of language. It tends to be on the left, even if you're left-handed. So we say, oh, this is going to be tough. Tough for the patient, tough for us. So there are places we can part and essentially gently divide through a narrow tunnel and get to deep-seated tumors. So there's that amount of redundancy in certain parts of the brain.
When you hear about what the brain's made up of, it's just like a gooey gunge in there, isn't it?
I couldn't go into a body, human or otherwise, that's still alive. I
mean, really?
It a bit graphic carving up a chicken, you know, when I'm roast on Sunday.
Yeah.
So I don't know, something's still with a pulse.
When I'm speaking to him, though, because we know so little about the brain, it really feels like, you know, when operating theatres used to genuinely be a theatre.
Yes.
People used to come and watch. And, you know, the guy used to saw his leg off or something. Yeah.
People used to faint. And front rows used to get splattered in blood.
It feels a bit like that with the brain at the moment. We know so little about it, really. It feels like we might as well be going in there with, you know, sticks from the garden, because we're literally, you know...
Never operate on my brain, Tim.
We know so little about it, but, you know, it's fascinating. Anyway, I thoroughly enjoyed that one. Okay, next clip, Mark.
Well, this is Liz Bonin, who was brilliant. The environment, you know, was a very big topic this year, wasn't it? And I think it's, you know, only going to get more so. She was great. What she was funny and engaging and passionate about the thing that she really cares about. And this is a slightly light-hearted clip, but it was about Turtlegate.
Yeah.
And actually, it starts off light-hearted, but then she's quite open about how it affected her. I just thought she was great, and that was a great clip.
Do we need to explain Turtlegate, or does she do it in the clip?
Do you know what? Explain it, and it won't matter if it's explained.
Okay. She's on her program, and they've let some baby turtles go, and the turtles have to go down to the sea, and they swim and then live and escape and have beautiful, happy lives. Sadly, a seagull wasn't in on the production meeting and swept down. And whilst Liz was presenting to the camera, it picked the turtle up in its mouth and took it off to eat. And then there was uproar, as everybody said it was Liz and the BBC's fault for not protecting the baby turtles. Here's the clip. Next question: what's the biggest mistake you've made?
Oh my god!
Do you know what? Can I just give you the answer to that?
You know the biggest mistake I've made.
No, but it made me laugh. Because I don't know whether you're going to like me
saying this. Oh no! Wait, you have to whisper it to me first in case I don't like what you're going to say.
No, because it was brilliant and people went mental.
Oh no! I know what you're going to say. Go on.
When the baby turtle got picked up by the seagull.
That was not a mistake.
I know it wasn't.
Can I explain
myself?
I know
it wasn't. Yeah,
so first of all, I didn't see the seagull, right? Because it was behind me.
I know you didn't.
The perspective.
It was nature.
You're so funny.
It was nature living
everyone,
it out.
People, it was nature. We did have a film in episode one where we released, well, we didn't release, they all came out of the nest, 70 went out, and a few got picked off. We didn't show it in the film, and I think perhaps that was a mistake on our part, because it's part of the cycle. And I say to the scientist, oh God, look at this. She goes, and I say, I saw little chicks with their little fluffy brown chicks with little spots.
Yeah.
The gulls, chicks, you know, they need to be fed too.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, as my big goodbye, and I had practiced this noble ending of why you must protect the planet, the seagull was literally almost giving us the fingers going, yeah, I'm taking this. I mean, you have to laugh.
So,
and I don't mean to be disrespectful to the wildlife, but...
Liz released a little baby turtle. It was crawling into
six of them.
And as she was doing her last piece of camera, seagull came, took the turtle and went off with it.
And went off.
And I'm laughing because it's just nature.
It's nature, everyone.
We've become so numb to nature, I think, now. And I think it's really weird. Like when David Attenborough and all these things, when animals are being chased by other animals, we're sitting there going, that's disgusting. You know, I think we now don't like the... I've got a cat here. I've got a murderer.
No, I'm taking your cat home, by
it's
the way.
It's a murderer living in my house. It's pretty crap murderer, if I've got to be honest with you. But any remote butterfly, insect or anything comes in this house, it's being attacked by my cat. Mm. You know, that's kind of nature. But we don't like it. And we're like, no, I don't want anyone to kill anything
Meanwhile,
anymore.
Meanwhile, we're the biggest killers the planet has ever seen.
Everything.
Get a grip. Yeah. Just to explain once and for all, you know... These were six turtles. that normally are left in the nest because they don't really climb out. So it was post the big exodus of the main ones. It does happen at dawn and dusk. It does happen during the day. We didn't orchestrate it or ask her to hold on to them and then release them later. The seagulls do predate on them. That's nature. I didn't see the seagull behind me. If I had, I would have commented on it. Everyone relax. It's the cycle of life. But I was trolled for the first time properly.
Yeah, you
I'm
got
a
grief.
Turtle killer. I've got a turtle. Not on my hands. And because I was so knackered for about 3 days, I took it personally and now I'm over it. Yeah, I did because I was really,
I shouldn't have brought it up then.
No, don't be silly. I'm so over it now. Oh, and I'm glad you brought it up. We were getting up at crazy o'clock, you know.
And you pointed out that if you actually place the turtle in the sea, they have to crawl in.
It has to walk to get that kind of drive. The reaction was insane, but it does make me laugh. And I was actually at the BBC at a meeting yesterday. And we were talking about it again, going, you know, it's almost comical that the seagull was like,
yeah,
by the way, I'm
brilliant.
Getting on with my life, everyone. Yeah. It was, it's like W1H's wildlife. I loved it.
Yeah.
In a way. Do you know what I mean?
The grief,
you know what I mean?
The grief you were getting was horrible, by the way. It was ridiculous. It sort of
don't
made...
you understand, girls? Well, actually, I do. They're scavengers. They don't. You should have wrestled the turtle out of the seagull's
legs. Everyone get rid of the seagulls now? Just get rid of all the seagulls. We're about to do a scene. You know,
and there are no such thing as seagulls, by the way. They're all gulls of a different species. And also, we look at them because they've become scavengers here because we've made them scavengers. I mean, just before you attack someone, just inform yourself.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to look, I should be respectful to everybody's opinions, but when those opinions are so ridiculous, I just don't have patience for it. Yeah. I mean, bring it on. I've learned my lesson now. It doesn't touch me anymore. It doesn't affect me anymore.
The good
it's
thing
ridiculous.
About Twitter is I get to see you're posting really important stuff. The bad thing is you can get trolled and
you
stuff.
You do.
Right. You know what? Liz Bonnen has become important, whether she likes it or not, because her, Chris Packham, Attenborough, all of them have become really important because they are doing the natural history shows that we love. We love watching it. We love watching animals. We love watching nature. And they're selling the message to us about single-use plastic and how we're looking after our environment. And I think we're not doing a good job of looking after our environment. But everybody's now... I think, as I keep saying on this podcast, everybody's champing at the bit. Everybody's ready. We all want to do our bit. We all desperately want to come on board to help the environment. If the supermarkets come on board, I think most people will go, yeah, come on, show us what we can do, how we can help, how we can help do it. So, but people like her, it's a real responsibility for her, because. I think they're just making TV shows and they're passionate and they suddenly realize that. They're actually becoming, when we look back, these people are becoming important people because they're representing and they're giving us the information, aren't they?
Yeah.
And Liz is such a lovely woman, really lovely. Yeah. And she's so passionate about it all. Great, fantastic guest. Our next guest is also passionate.
I mean, this is probably the highlight of the year for me.
It's Chris Kamara.
I just loved him.
Must have been tough to have picked a clip though, because he said so many fascinating things.
I went for the story that I didn't know before he told it, which was how he started. I won't ruin it, but it was quite an interesting way into football. And and again, with these clips, I was trying to pick something that evoked was evocative of the whole interview. And I thought this highlighted that he likes to talk, but he's self-deprecating and he's funny and interesting. And I just thought it was how he started in football, basically.
And it's worth... okay. All right, let's listen to it. Here's Chris Kamara.
Well, my dad made me. Can you imagine making your kids do anything?
No.
My dad made me join the Royal Navy. So I had the opportunity to be an apprentice footballer at Middlesbrough. And I went home and I said, Dad, I've got a chance. Dave Richardson's going to come around tomorrow and see you. Because we didn't have a phone or anything. And Dave Richardson came around to see me dad. He was the head of Middlesbrough Boys. And my dad said, no, he's going in the Navy. He made my brother join the Army. He said, he's going in the Navy. So he made me join the Navy. And that's where fate took a hand. Because the Navy football team trained at Torpoint in Devon, where I was sent to. And I went down to watch them play, the Navy team, and I asked the coach if I could join in, and he said, no, three reasons. And I said, well, one, you're only here for a 6 months trial because you got the decision at the end of 6 months where you could walk away or they could tell you you're not good enough. Two, you're black and these lot will kick lumps out of you because, like I said, that was the middle 70s. And three, you're too skinny and frail. Well, I'd been playing men's football from the age of 14 on a Sunday morning, so I can handle myself. But he obviously didn't know that. And then I kept going back down, and I was running around the track one day, and he came to me and he said, oh, I'm two players short for a practice match. You play on one side and I'll play on the other. You just stay out on the wing, keep yourself out of trouble, and you'll be fine. Anyway, I scored two goals, and they tried to kick lumps out of me, and they couldn't get anywhere near me. And I got drafted straight into the team. And I said to him, I thought you said I couldn't do that in 6 months. He went, well, we'll sort that out, don't we? And so we played against Portsmouth, reserve team, and I scored two goals against them. And the coach, Ray Crawford, used to play for Ipswich, Colchester, asked the Navy coach how old I was. He said he's 16. So he went to Ian St. John and said, I want to buy a lad out of the Navy. He said, how much is it going to cost?
Ian St. John from St. Greaves, eh?
Ian St. John, yeah, he was the manager of Pompey, yeah. So he said, how much is it going to cost? He said, £200. So they bought me out of the Navy for £200. It still goes down as the worst deal in the club's history. and the rest is history, yeah. And Ian St. John, 2 months later, gave me my debut against Luton. And I scored on my second game away at Bolton.
Do you wish you were playing now? Do you wish it was in this era with the money and the
different... No. You can't change anything. That's what I said to you. Fate plays a massive part in your life. If history was changed in any way, shape or form, I wouldn't have the wonderful kids that I've got. I wouldn't have the wonderful grandkids that I've got. So you cannot change anything.
Chris Kamara is such a lovely guy. Again, one of those characters, you strolled into this kitchen, just lit it up.
Yeah. Like you do, Tim.
Just like I do, but that's because I know where the light switch is. Hey!
Wow!
Woo!
It's the first job you've ever done.
Chris is, by the way, if you enjoyed that, listen back to the podcast I did with him, his views on racism in football, as in racism aimed at the footballers and how they should stay on the pitch and not leave the pitch, was a really interesting take.
Really interesting and goes against the grain of a lot of...
amazing. Amazing his views. His views on everything are amazing. It's a really lovely podcast and you will not regret sitting down for an hour and 10 minutes, however it was, and listening to Chris Kamara talk. He's fantastic conversation.
His Christmas album too.
Yeah.
Christmas Kamara.
Get on it. I love the fact that he's doing that. I just like watching his life because I've known him for so many years now. I just love his enthusiasm for life. And he's just genuinely a good guy, which is nice. What clip's up next?
Right, well, I chose Menna and Jen. And do you, I don't know if you remember, you will of course remember this. Menna was the blind skier. And Jen was her...
Eyes,
basically. And, I was thinking, you know, we've all had a tough year and it might get a bit tougher, we don't know. And I just thought the next time you have a metaphorical or, you know, allegorical mountain in front of you, just remember this girl, she... skis down it blind. And it's amazing.
It is absolutely amazing. She blew me away, actually. I hate to use this word because it's so overused, but the bravery of throwing yourself down a mountain. I do a lot of snowboarding and I get terrified going fast, you know, after a while, because you do notice that the ground's quite hard.
Yeah.
And she's throwing herself down there and she's blind. It's amazing. But they're such a lovely couple.
They were brilliant. And it was so nice to have them in the kitchen.
Okay, let's have a listen. How do you ski though? Because obviously when I ski, I'm using my sight. How are you doing it? When I've been up a mountain, it goes white out. It's so scary when you can't see what you're actually doing, and the floor just keeps dropping away, doesn't it, from you? You know, Jen, you must have experienced
that. Well,
that's
when I'm having a horrible time. Mena's having a great time because she's got a recce in front of her who is experiencing all of these lumps. And Mena's 5% actually, especially in low light, the contrast of my high-vis jacket, because I'm an orange blob in front of her,
yeah.
Against the whiteout and the snow, actually means that Mena can probably see better in whiteout conditions than she can in some other conditions.
Oh, right, okay.
So I'm the one having a really rubbish time up ahead, and Mena's like, oh, this is...
I don't know what you're talking
I know exactly
about.
Where that lump is, right? I'll avoid that. yeah, so... It balances out, I think, yeah. Depending on the conditions.
Yeah, but it's how do you do it then? How do you what are you do your other senses, have they come alive to skiing? Are you listening? Are you feeling? What's happening?
Yeah, I suppose they do. I'm listening to Jen's communications, but I'm also listening to the sound of her skis and whether I can hear it being a soft sound. So I know it's softer snow or ice. It would make a louder sound, but I'm also listening to other people around as well. I can tell if someone's going to come up behind me or by the sound. And yeah, as you said, I can almost feel my way down the slope. Yeah,
because snow is obviously different, the ice and the snow, and you get that crunch, don't you, if it's a fresher snow, and also then it gets icy. So I suppose but it does change as you come down.
Yeah, every turn sometimes, yeah. and so we have a sort of code that we've worked, because we've been working together for quite a while now, we've developed it, and I'll kind of say, if there's ice coming up, I will say stand on it rather than icy, which could mean Mena goes defensive and like stop skiing well, so we use things like that to just describe the action for what to do when the snow changes, as opposed to just saying turn, 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 which is your basic command.
Okay, so what I'm trying to get my head, I've watched you a lot do it, but I cannot understand how you're giving instructions. How's it? By the way, it's via a Bluetooth headset.
That's yes. Right, on a yeah. helmet.
What if that breaks, by the way? Does it ever happen?
It does. It happened in both runs of the gold-winning slalom run, and it just went off. And you'll see, if you watch it closely, I hit the side of my head, because that's where the button is, to turn it back on, and thankfully it did go back on.
Oh, God.
So, but who knows why it turned off twice. It just, yeah. So it does happen, but you just... We agreed beforehand that if anything happens to the comms, I'll sort it out. Mena's got enough to deal with. And so that's our standard operating procedure, to use a military term.
Yeah.
And we've also trained.
We've practiced without. That scenario and to make sure it isn't a massive shock and that we can just carry on doing the job at hand. And
how? Just by shouting?
Shouting and following.
We do shout a lot.
Yeah. Even with the comms.
I follow Mena and Jen on social media, and it's worth it. They get up to all sorts, those two, always together, and they've great partnership. What's next, Mark?
Well, now this is slightly inspired by, as we're wandering into the Christmas period, the feeling that everyone gets on the day after Boxing Day and goes, oh no, I've got to shift some ton.
Yeah, can I give my advice?
I know what your advice is.
Go on.
Well, your advice is just don't overeat.
Like, the problem with buying into Christmas.
Here we go. Here's Scrooge.
No, right. So there's your first
problem. Well, no, but you're the Grinch. Grinch. You're
right,
the Grinch.
Exactly. Because I
don't start this. No. I'm not saying you're wrong.
This is a selection. This is a selection box, and we're arguing on our selection box.
Yes, well, you took the chocolate orange.
I would go for the long toffee chocolate ones.
Oh, yuck, they're so depressing.
Oh, they're the best. Well, you go for the chocolate orange.
I love chocolate orange.
No, you need something to chew. So what annoys me about Christmas is Christmas can be wonderful for everyone. It's a tough time for most people, by the way, because it's the time where family comes together. And when family comes together, it just, all the problems raise their heads. It's okay for kids because they're...
Keep it light, Tim.
But as soon as you put your head up and go, hold on, we need to change Christmas because it's bullshit, right? It is bullshit. And as soon as you go that, everyone goes, oh, Scrooge, it's the Grinch, it's the Scrooge. Right, number one, if you've got any children, can you make sure they don't listen to this bit, please? I'll give you 2 seconds.
Don't you dare. Don't
Number
you,
one.
Don't you dare.
Number
don't
one.
Don't you dare.
Let me finish. Father Christmas.
I am editing this.
Father Christmas. Hold on, Mark. Father Christmas means tests presents. It's bullshit. You're a rich kid, you get a bike. You're a poor kid, you get secondhand Lego. Do the kids not think when they go to school and say, hey, what did you get? And they go to a school where all the kids aren't rich or all poor or whatever. You go to the kids, it's a random mixture. They go, hold on, how come that kid gets a bike and I got secondhand Lego?
So you're suggesting no one gets presents? Come on, Tim. If you're going to raise these questions, you need some answers.
I have said in the past it should maybe be called Bookmas, but if we take it away from a mythical character of Father Christmas, then at least you can sit
Steady.
There in your at least you can sit in your playground or whatever as a kid and go, well, the reason why he got a bike and I got secondhand Lego was because his parents are rich. And mine aren't. At least you get it. Whereas the mythical character, you go, hold on, why does that guy, and even if you're not quite thinking, you're thinking, why does the guy who comes through the chimney like him more than me? Why is he getting more than me or she getting more than me or whatever? So that's your number one thing. And the number two thing is people have to overdo everything. So people spend money they don't have. And it's like, it's madness. It's like, then you put yourself in crap for the rest of the year. Why do that? And number three, people overindulge in, my gym is empty at the moment because everyone's out at Christmas parties constantly. So they eat and drink too much and they overindulge. And then they get to January and they're like, oh God, I feel terrible. And what are they doing it all? They're all doing it because they want to have fun.
Joe Wicks, he was great. He was a great guest. So depressing.
All this, you're so depressing sometimes. All this happiness and fun.
You're so depressing sometimes. Well, anyway.
In amongst all that crap, there is some actual reality. There is some sense in amongst all the nonsense. You know, have one Christmas party a year. You don't have to have 30 of the bloody things. And why is it?
Fucking
hell. I'm amusing myself. I'm talking so much shit. But why does everyone get to December?
Listen, like, don't worry. It's going to get back on the rails soon. Don't worry.
How many texts do you have to get off people at Christmas going, let's meet up before Christmas? You know you're not going to do it. And if you are going to do it, you're going to have to meet up with everyone and get hammered constantly for the whole month of December. You wake up on January the 1st, January the 1st, and you go, I feel terrible. No shit. You've just stuffed yourself full of food and beer and champagne and whatever, vodka, whatever else you're drinking these days.
Joe Guest was a...
Oh, my days.
Joe Wicks was a great guest. You put me totally off my...
Clearly I have. Wow.
Joe Wicks was a great guest.
Woo! Joe Wicks
was a great guest.
Joe Wicks was a great guest.
And here you ask him the question, which I think is a good question. I think everybody wants to know is what is more important, diet or exercise? And he answers it here. Stop talking, Tim.
Okay, here's Joe Wicks.
So yeah, high intensity interval training involves like short bursts of effort followed by a rest period. So let's say you were going to do it on a cardio machine, like a treadmill, a spin bike or a rowing machine. You just basically go 100% like full effort for say 30 seconds. So maximum resistance, speed, whatever you've got to do to get your heart rate to near maximum. And then you maybe rest for say a minute. And so you drop your heart rate, you recover, and then you go again. And I do it for about 15 to 20 rounds. And the kind of science behind it is that, you know, apparently so after the session's done, you've got this kind of post calorie, like burning post, they call it EPOC, which is basically means you're burning calories long after the workout's finished. And I just believe it, you know, it's something you can do at home with no equipment. So that's obviously with a machine, but if you're doing it at home, you can do basic things like running on the spot, squats, press-ups, burpees, lunge jumps, mountain climbers. So you can have a really fit, lean physique just with your body weight.
Do you know Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile? That he used to, the way he trained for it was he could only train in his lunch breaks. So he used to go up and I might be making this up, by the way, you'll have to check this, but I think he used to run 400 meters as fast as he could
wait till he got his breath back, run 400 meters again as fast as he could for as much as he could in half an hour, then go back to his job. And that's how he did it, which is basically HIIT training, isn't
it? Yeah, it's just classic interval training. Yeah. So interval training is like, you could do low intensity interval training, but HIIT is like max effort, because you're only going to think about it. If you're doing a 20 minute workout and you're doing, say, 30 seconds on, 30 seconds rest, you're only actually working out for 10 minutes. So you've got to think, right, I'm doing 10 minutes of effort. How can I get the most out of this session? And you've got to be going hard. Like, you know, you can't be plodding along and be like, oh, you know, this could be harder. You've got to really give it some. And in doing that, that's when you get the results.
What do you think is most more important, the exercise or the diet?
There's no kind of, everyone's looking for like a golden percentage, you know, 80-20 and all this. But you can't, I think, right, so exercise, you know, exercising is going to do so many things in terms of your energy. You're going to sleep better. You're going to feel more confident, you know, positive, productive. You're going to have a better day. You're going to enjoy life. And that's also linked to sleep. You're going to sleep better. But really what fuels us is our food and our nutrition. So I would say more than anything in the world, nutrition is the most important thing. You know, exercise is so important as well, but the food we put in, it determines how, you know, we digest food, what we absorb, how much energy we have, because you've got two extremes. You can be on a really, really low calorie diet, not getting enough food, and just feeling really lethargic and run down. And you've got, you know, the other end where you're eating way too much, you know, processed foods, like heavily, you know, sugars and carbohydrates that are going to zap your energy. You've got to find that sweet spot in the middle where you can still enjoy a few treats, but you're just fueling your body, like in line with your energy demand. Mm. So if you're really active, if you're like, you know, a labourer, you're on a building site and you're exercising, you can eat more food than someone who's sitting on their desk all day. So we're all very unique, but I honestly believe that food is the key to kind of true health and happiness, and then exercise is just a bonus.
Joe Wicks there.
While that clip was playing, Tim bent my ear some more. I cannot wait to leave.
Do you know why I like Joe Wicks? Is he's genuine, and he's a freak. It's a one-off. There's no one going to come along like Joe. He was right time, right place, perfect storm, honest, likable guy, talking sense, just boom. And the thing is, I've known him for quite a long time now, and he's still just so lovely, and he's still got all that, in the nicest possible way, he's still got all the lovely insecurities. Yeah. He's not sort of too big for his boots. He texted me afterwards, a few weeks after the podcast went out, went, hey Tim, the reaction of the podcast was really lovely, thank you. And it's like, yeah, it was, because he's genuinely a nice person, and God, I hope he keeps going, because his message is fantastic. He's a loving father, brilliant husband. He's into exercise. He's into fitness. And what is more, he's not into suffering to go with it. So if you follow his diets, I'm not trying to push him, by the way, but you can have a burger, you can have a steak, you can have some chocolate. He's not about ruining your life.
Does he let you go to a Christmas party, Tim?
Would Joe Wicks go to a Christmas party? I think he probably would.
Right. Okay.
I think he would. But what is interesting about Joe as well, and what I love, and if you get a chance, listen back to that podcast, is how he started. Because he was one of those guys who refused to give up. And he started with literally no one, no clients. And now, you know, multi-millionaire. Fantastic. Good luck to him. We've nearly come to the end of selection box. I've eaten all the long toffees. What comes out? I like the round toffees as well. I just like toffee.
I like soft sweets. I don't like putting my teeth through an ordeal at Christmas.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because toffee used to be a bigger thing. People do not eat toffee now. I reckon toffee sales have gone through, you know, plummeted massively. Yeah. What do people eat? They eat kids just eat chocolate. The most successful sweet at the moment is not a Mars bar or a Twix. It's the dairy
milk.
Dairy milk, yeah. Dairy milk is still the most successful chocolate you buy from wherever you buy it, newsagent, service station, petrol station, whatever. There you go. Fact for you. So what are we finishing off with?
We are going to go full circle. See, I've built a little narrative into this, narrative arc into this. And we're going...
Actually, before we go into this, can we just say we'd like to hear from you? It's a good opportunity as ever to say this. So we would love to hear from you. Could you please email us, dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. Anything you want to say. If you want me to sort out one of your problems, then I'll do that for you. If you want to just comment on our guests or anything about the show or suggest anything, we'd love to hear from you. Or you can tweet me at Tim Lovejoy. And I think my Instagram, I can never remember. I think it's Tim Lovejoy _official. But
I think it is. And the email.
I did it, didn't I? DealAfterAPodcast@gmail.com.
You might have done. Wasn't listening.
Yeah, so we got a jingle for that.
We have. It goes at the end of the podcast.
Too. Okay. All right. So we'll do that. You'll listen to this repeated at the end of the podcast as well. But go on, go into what our last segment is.
Well, yeah, as I said, before you interrupted me with the information we're going to hear at the end of the podcast anyway, we're going back full circle to Colin Salmon. And I wanted to include this because he had a nice meaning of life, and afterwards he played his trumpet. And I thought that would be a nice way to end our selection.
Okay, so that is the end of our selection box. So thanks for joining us this year. We thoroughly enjoyed it, have we?
I have, yeah. Good. So, don't look at me questioning you like...
We've learned masses.
Oh, man.
And we've learned so much. I've got so much information in my head. And then every now and then I just bring out a weird random fact. I think, where did I get that from? It's like, it's the podcast.
I got that from my own podcast.
Yeah, but it's so... I've learned so much that it's just been an absolute incredible... journey, as they say on X Factor, but it has, and hopefully we'll carry on doing loads more next year. Actually, next year there's some exciting developments we've got planned for this podcast. So,
are there?
Come to January, February. Things might start changing, but it'll still be the same.
Two dimwits,
but yeah, things are. Things are moving on in the world of podcasting. Anyway, that's it from us for this year. And, well, we'll see you in the new year. Oh, that's unbelievable. What great timing. It's the door. Mark, you introduce Colin Salmon. I'll get the door.
Well, I'd just like to wish you all a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And I will leave you in the capable trumpet player himself and actor, Mr. Colin Salmon.
What is the meaning of life?
Keep looking for it.
Have you found it?
A bit like my homosexuality. I don't think I've met the right one yet. It changes. I think it. Be in the moment. Be in the moment. Enjoy what you're doing. Be 100% all the time. So if I'm talking to you, I'm talking to you. And I'm driving home, I'll be driving home, and it's... Stay curious and try and let the memories be short. Forgive, but don't forget. And love your kids.
That's got to be it. Thank you so much for coming in, Con. Really good today.
Pleasure, mate. You got me choked up there. Finish
with a bit of trumpet? Go on.
There's been a lot of talk about the cars we drive, lovers we've known, diamonds and gold. Kiss and tell your business side of life. Well, to be perfectly honest, it's starting to leave me cold. It's time to think about the world we're in. There's bridges down, work to do. The fear I have inside is this gap's become too wide, you see. We've all seen those children on the streets. Cotton hoods, ice cold feet. Unanswered questions in their eyes. Bad things happen, no surprise. Then we hear about these mothers at home, lots of friends, yet they feel alone. Some dare to judge them without grace when they've never met them face to face. I believe it's time our villages work this out with quiet words and deeds, not blame and shout. Some say it came down from the top. All I know is this madness has to stop. It's not just about the money in the bank. It's more about the fact that people do not say thank you. Or may I? Would you mind? Have you got time? Would you be so kind? In our heart of hearts, we know one thing, and that is no child. I repeat, no child. I'll say it again. No child should be left behind.
There you go.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, written and hosted by Tim Lovejoy and produced by Mark Augustin. If you would like to contact us, then our email address is dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. Or Tim is on Twitter @TimLovejoy and on Instagram @TimLovejoy_official.